Greetings in the name of Jesus. Not sure how to start. Usually when I preach a message, I have a little bit of an introduction, and I usually have some notes for that, but I just could not get one this morning. And so I decided I'll just come and just see what the Spirit gives me. And Dwight had my introduction. There's no reason for an introduction. But I've been blessed at being here this morning already, just so much. I just love Sunday mornings, and I just love church, and I just love being with you all, and I just love seeing how the Spirit works in each one's life, and how the service just brings glory to God. I was blessed with the devotional this morning as well. The presence of God, how we need that presence. And then Dwight's opening in how we make choices and what happens when we make bad choices. Ultimately, we lose a connection with that presence, don't we? Ultimately, when we make bad choices, it leads to a separation of the... there's restitution. And there's... We can find forgiveness, and we can find grace, or God gives grace. It doesn't have to lead to separation, but it does. Bad choices, following ourselves, will lead us away from God. And my message this morning is a little bit along the same lines. It's seeking restitution, or seeking to bring that one back, or seeking to bring back, or to restore the ones who have wandered away from God, the ones who are no longer in the fold, the one that is missing. So I don't know if you remember my last message or not. I preached on confession, and towards the end of that message, I made a comment about, I'm not sure exactly how it was, but I just brought in a little bit about creating a church culture where we are able to share with one another, and where we can feel free to confess and to be open with one another. And I wasn't really planning on preaching a sequel to that message, and I don't know if this is really a sequel to it, but as I got towards the end of my message, I was like, well, did I say some of these things earlier? And so I went back and looked at my last message, and I don't know that I really, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's a little bit along the same line. It's about seeking restoration for the lost, seeking restoration for the one who falls away or chooses his own way. And for a message text this morning, you can turn to Matthew chapter 18, and I'm not sure if I ever quite read Matthew 18 like I read it here in the past week, and where it jumped out to me. And so if I say some things that they weren't exactly new to me, but some of them were a little bit, I never quite put them together the way I did when I read this passage here last week. Matthew chapter 18, let's read verses 1 through 15 to begin. I think this sets this creates the setting of the passage, and I think this setting is important to the message. It's not the message, these first 15 verses, but I think it's important to the message. At the same time, the disciples came unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus called a little child unto him, and set him in the midst of them, and said, "Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive one such little one in my name receiveth me. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him if a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. For it is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire. Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. For the Son of Man is come to save that which was lost. How think ye? If a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99, and goeth into the mountains, and seeketh that which is gone astray? And if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. The disciples came to Jesus with a question. And that question was, who is going to be greatest in the kingdom of heaven? What can we do? Well, they didn't ask that, but who's going to be the greatest? What's it going to take? And Jesus responded by taking the least, right? He took a child, a little child. I don't know how little the child was. And he elevated him to the greatest. In order to be the greatest, you have to first of all become the least, the most unimportant. You can't be the greatest by seeking your own interest or seeking what's best for yourself. And from there, Jesus moved on to offenses. And this is all one passage. And this is where I'm not sure I quite always read it as one passage, but I think this is all Jesus teaching this all in one coherent message. And even the rest of the chapter, I think it all flows. Jesus moved on to offenses. Offenses are going to come, but we need to be careful that we are not the one that causes the offense. In fact, if we are the one that causes the offense, and he mentions especially little ones, but I think he was talking about more than just actual children. Because remember, he said, the least in the kingdom of heaven is like unto this person. So the most vulnerable person in the kingdom of heaven, if we cause an offense, and I think we can put that to anybody in the kingdom of heaven, if we are the one that is causing the offense, it's bad for us. It were better if we had a millstone hung around our neck and if we were cast into the midst of the sea. I can't think of many things that would be worse ways of dying. Imagine a millstone around your neck, pushed off the boat. But that were better than if we were causing the offense. He goes on to the parable of the lost sheep. Again, he highlights the value of each life that it has in the kingdom of heaven, and he highlights the persistence that Jesus has when pursuing these lost sheep. And these were sheep that were in the fold, I believe. These were sheep that had been there and they wandered away. You know, Jesus' attitude toward those sheep is not, well, I hope he finds his way back. Or, I have a 99% success rate. Like, 99 of them were still there. I used to raise veal calves for my dad. We had 64, I think. Our barn held 64, if I remember right. And we always bought, of the little ones, I think usually 68 or 70. Because we expected some to die. The first couple of weeks, you're buying little calves, right? They're one-week-old calves or a couple-day-old calves. You expect some to die. Out of 64, if you can go your whole batch and only lose two or three, we were very satisfied. But Jesus was not like this. We consider that a good success rate, right? I don't know, what is that? 2 out of 64, somebody who's better at math than me, is that like a 96% or something like that? 94 maybe, I'm not sure. Pretty good, not bad. But a 99, Jesus left those 99. And I don't know where he left them. The CSB, I think, read, he left them on a hillside and went and pursued the sheep. So on a safe place, most likely, and then he left those sheep. If you look at the Bible story books, I think he puts them in the fold and he goes and that's Bible story books. And he goes and he pursues the one sheep. But he left those 99 to pursue the one. And this setting of Jesus teaching on the kingdom and his care for each individual, his care for that one sheep, And for the least in the kingdom of heaven is important. It's not my message this morning. And the passage that I read this morning, these first 15 message or first 14 verses, there's probably multiple messages in here. But what I want to get out of this is just a basis or a foundation. I think it's important to the part where it comes to restoring the lost. Because I think it is our responsibility, and we'll get into that a little bit more, I think it is our responsibility as a church to restore that one sheep and to pursue that one sheep. Verse 14 is where I often stop because it kind of changes subject. It kind of changes the subject, doesn't it? First, we're talking about the sheep, and then we go about your brother trespassing against you. But I think we're still in the same context. And the reason I think that, well, let's go ahead and read Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 19. Moreover, if thy brother, and notice that word, moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it unto the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto thee as a heathen man and a publican. Verily I say unto you, that whatsoever ye shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever ye shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And again I say unto you, that if two of you shall agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it shall be done for them of my Father which is in heaven. And I want to come back a little bit, and I want to look at that word moreover, because that word moreover, I never noticed it before. But that word moreover, I think, is a pretty important word in this passage. It's translated from the Greek word de, very little word, de. And it is a particle that acts as an adversative or a continuative transition. Now, that's a big description for that little word. Basically, it's a conjunction. It ties the two passages together. The following verses continue the thoughts from the previous verses, and it's a fairly universal particle. It can be continuative or it can be like adversative. So it could be like a cause and effect almost, or it could be because of this. That's kind of what it is. Because of this, this happens. Because Jesus has such a care for that one sheep, this happens. Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee. You know, I read this passage, or when I would have used to read this passage, verses 15 through 22 here, it's almost, like I said, it almost changes the subject there. I don't know if I ever read them together, or that I ever really put them together. It almost seems to be in opposition to the rest of Jesus' teaching at first glance. Because you have Jesus showing such care for each individual, such care for each person, such care for the least of these. And then he goes to, if thy brother trespass against thee, you go and tell him it alone. Almost like maybe we do have some right to justify ourselves, or to, if our pride has been wounded, we do have some right to restore that. Almost a passage of justice. Maybe I still don't understand this passage. If I don't, I would like you to let me know. But as a young believer, I viewed this passage almost with confusion. The rest of the gospel message, you have non-resistance, you have good returning good for evil, and Jesus, you have the example of Jesus, he never sought his own way, did he? He never sought his own will. He never sought to be, the word that I want there is just leaving me a little bit. He never sought to be justified. He never sought to be on top. And in this passage, it almost gives us a license to defend ourselves. And I think because of that phrase, sins against thee, we think we might have that right, or I might have that right to protect myself against slights. But I just don't think that's the case. There are some other translations that leave that out entirely, and some translations that I would consider to be sound translations that read the passage, if thy brother sins, go and tell him his fault. I think the ESV has against thee in this passage, but in the parallel passage in Luke, I think it's Luke 17, it leaves it out. I think it's the ESV that does. But I'm not sure we should leave it out. Against and thee are translated from both from Greek words. They both have their own Greek word, and so they were in the original text. But I do wonder if in translation we have lost some of the weight of Jesus' teaching, of Jesus' meaning here. Again, that word for against, and of course as the English language keeps evolving, these words kind of have different meanings to us. The word against here is again translated from a Greek preposition this time, that it's a very, very universal preposition. And it basically means the arrival at a time or place. And so I think we can read this. Moreover, if thy brother sins at thee or around thee or where you're at, if you are aware of it, then that makes you responsible. If thy brother sins and you see it and you are aware of it, you are responsible for it. Luther German, I think, actually uses the preposition at. It gives it just a little bit of a different flavor there. Again, if I'm missing the mark entirely, or if I'm taking scripture out of context, please let me know. But that's brotherhood accountability, isn't it? If I am aware of a fault in your life, I try to help you be restored. And if you are aware of one in mine, you try to help me. I think that is Jesus' desire for the church. So I don't think Jesus was transitioning in verse 15 from expressing his care and his concern for each individual to telling us how to protect ourselves. I don't think that's his transition at all, but rather I think he transitions from his care, his concern for each one, to telling us how to live that out, to telling us how to display that. He gives an example of the church in operation. And so how do I apply this passage? How do I live it out in everyday shoe leather? To begin with, if I am approaching someone about an error, or if I see a sin in someone's life and I want to seek restoration, I can't do so with a desire to seek justice. I can't go with a desire to see that person get what he deserves. But I need to desire restoration as Jesus did. Restoration for that sheep. Restoration for that lost person. That has to be the heart, my heart, if I am going to help someone be restored to the fold. Restoration for his relationship with me if the sin was against me. Restoration for his relationship with the Father, with the church. And we can only do so if our hearts already hold no animosity toward him. Leviticus 19, verse 17, this is out of the law. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer or wish sin upon him. That's the law of God. That's Moses' law. That's what he told Moses. It's a law of love. Rebuking, yes. Pointing out errors, but with a heart of love. Conquering sin, not with eye for an eye. We think of the law as a law that promoted eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, promoted punishment for sin, right? And there was a place for that. But conquering sin, not with hate, not with eye for an eye, but with love. I think that's the heart of God. That's the foundation. That's the first thing I need if I am to restore the lost sheep, the one sheep. But I think there's also a little bit more involved in that. And I think, I speak this mostly from experience, when we see an offense, consider first of all why it is an offense. And maybe I'll put in here the word for offense, and I did not write this down, but the Greek is basically a stumbling block or a slipping up, and it uses a couple different Greek words in a couple different passages that are, like Luke I think uses a different one than Matthew. And it could actually have the meaning of especially a sexual connotation. And so it can be just about any kind of sin, as from what I read it. It's not just a slight. It can be anything. I think it can apply to most anything. But when we see an offense, we need to first of all consider why it is an offense. You know, there are times that I have my pride wounded, and I immediately go on the defensive and say, well, that person is out of line, or that person is out of line. And they need to be set straight. When if I really take a closer look, it's me that's out of line. And so, I think we need to have that clear first of all. Maybe I was corrected, and it's the old man in me that wants to seek justice for having been wounded, for having been corrected. And I latch on to a passage like this, the one we just read, and I use it as an excuse to right the wrong that has been done to me. Oftentimes what we perceive to be an offense might just be a misunderstanding. So consider your own error. Consider that you may be in the wrong and approach your brother with that attitude that you too are prone to error. You too might be in the wrong. Proverbs 25:8-9. Go not forth hastily to strive, lest thou know not what to do in the end thereof, when thy neighbor hath put thee to shame. Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another. I like that word debate. It means to toss or to grapple in the way it was used here. So discuss it. Like, hey, I just noticed that, you know, you weren't in church for several weeks. Like, I just wondered if anything's going on. Discuss it, first of all. Don't be too quick to jump to conclusions. Maybe it was just a misunderstanding. Do you know how many divisions begin with a misunderstanding that has not been properly cleared up? I don't know that we can really put a number on this, but I would dare to say that it is a large amount of them. Divisions in relationships, personal relationships, divisions in the church, divisions in marriages, divisions in a nation. Just a little bit of talking and openness to one another can go a long way to helping to clear some of these. And as we debate that, as we discuss that, realize that I can be the one in the wrong as well, that I need correction at times. But there's another instruction here that I think is also so vital to church relationships, so vital to all relationships, actually. And that is, as we are seeking the lost, as we are seeking that one, it's between thee and him alone. It starts between thee and him alone. And I'm not talking about getting counsel from your husband or your wife. I don't think that's it. Those are closed relationships. But I do think when we take that supposed sin, that supposed offense, and we share it with our families, and with our brothers, and with our sisters, and with our friends, before we clarify that, I think we have already failed in that first step. We don't need to get a couple people on our side before we approach or before we discuss that with the brother or sister, because, brothers and sisters, it is not about sides. If it is about sides, then we have completely missed the foundation that I think Jesus was trying to lay here with that lost sheep, seeking that lost sheep. It is about the church of Jesus Christ, and it is about restoring that one individual to the fold. Keeping it between you and him alone, I think it does multiple things. First of all, it protects the offender, if it is an offender, from unnecessary humiliation or, like, because those things hurt, those things sting. And it also keeps you, if you approach him or if you are helping him, it also helps to have an attitude of teachableness yourself. You are going to be more effective. I am going to be more effective if I come to you and say, I've noticed this, I just didn't know if there's something going on or if I can help you in some way, rather than if that person finds out that you have shared it with half the church already and he's already building a base against you. You quickly become the offender instead of the one helping the offender. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19 through 23. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without the law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak, became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that by all means, that I may by all means, that I might by all means save some. Thinking of that lost sheep, thinking of that one sheep, thinking of that one individual that has left the fold, that has strayed the fold, that has gone out into the world. Can we say he's weak? Can we consider him weak? Can I make myself weak to gain the weak? Can I identify? Can I meet him on his level? Can I meet her on her level? And I'm not justifying sin here by any means. I'm not saying we need to be in sin to help the ones in sin. That's not what I'm saying. But I do not need to. I do not need to hold myself as higher than them. Because we need to realize that we all are also prone to that same. We are also prone to sin. We are also prone to the same thing. We are also prone to falling away. And there are times when discussing your differences will not bring restoration. That is, I think, when we establish a witness. Call it step two. This is almost a step-by-step process here in Matthew. I think that's when we establish the witness. We take one or two more, and we go back. We approach, we say it again, like, I really have a concern for you here. Like, is there some way I can help you? And this thing of witnesses was not something that was foreign to the disciples. It's throughout the Old Testament. Witnesses, it took two witnesses to condemn someone under the law, and it also took two witnesses to bring an accusation, I believe, or to at least an accusation that held weight in court. In Deuteronomy 19, verse 15, I won't turn to it, but it says, "One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth. For at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established." In order for sin to be established, in order for it to be a case that held weight in court, there had to be more input than just one-on-one. There had to be at least two or three witnesses. And that holds over into Jesus' teaching here. I think it witnesses give it more weight. There's safety in multiple witnesses in more ways than one. Others might see my blind spot. I could think I'm approaching the brother with a complete lack of animosity and I have forgiveness in my heart. But others might see where I'm not free of bitterness. Others might see where I have been affected and I have not let go of that, even though I think I have. And as we go, there's in the witnesses that we choose, or in the people that we choose to share this with, the first people, the one or two witnesses, we do well to choose wisely in that. And we have direction, I believe, on who to choose. Choose the opinion of a trusted brother, of somebody who's grounded in the faith, or sister. I say brother in these, but I think this applies to both sides of the house. Choose the opinion. Choose to confide in someone that you know you can confide in. One who will not compromise the confidence of the offending brother. One who will also be able to tell you your faults. Galatians 6:1. Two verses here I'm going to read, verses 1 and 2. "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." Ye who are spiritual, choose someone that you know is rooted, is grounded. And again, our goal for this confrontation or our goal for correction, again, is still, and this is always the goal, it's to restore that one sheep to the fold. It's to restore the hurting. It's to restore the one who's struggling, who's lost, who needs help finding his way. And again, that's less likely to happen if he feels you building a case with your peer than if he sees you coming with your own life open for correction. "Remove first the beam that is in thine own eye, and then you will be able to see the to remove the speck that is in your brother's eye. That's in Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. I don't think we'll turn to it for lack of time. But I wonder how often that beam that needs to be removed from mine own eye before I remove the speck in my brother's eye is gossip. I wonder how often that's the case. You know, sometimes these things make juicy stories. But if I can lay those stories aside with the interest of my brother or sister, if my interest is really to restore them to the fold, it will go a long way towards accomplishing that process. Throughout this process of seeking restoration for our brother to the church, we need to be aware of our own tendency for sin. Not even of our own tendency, but of our own faults, realizing that we too are prone to error. We too have faults. You know, I cringe a little bit, and I've heard this a couple times. When I hear someone make a comment about someone else, a derogative comment because of a choice they have made in their life, I'm not defending sin. But we have an enemy who is very real and who wants to see us at all times fall into sin. And but for the grace of God, we would all be there. We need not fear sin. We need not fear that we are going to fall into sin, that sometime it's just going to happen, because we have within us a power that is greater than the enemy. But let's not forget that we are capable of falling. And then finally, the last part here in Matthew chapter 18, the last step here. If there is still in the face of multiple witnesses, if there is still unrepentance, that's when we seek the counsel of the church, I believe. Notice that's the last step. And we have a tremendous blessing in the church that we can find counsel in the church. Because if our motives are pure, and if we are seeking restitution, if we are seeking to help someone who's hurting, we can find safety in the church. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Andy read that in his devotional this morning. There's strength in the church. There's direction in the church. And I say this carefully. Again, I open this, anything I said this morning, I open it to correction. It's not my responsibility as an individual to decide judgment or to withhold fellowship from a brother or sister. What I mean by that is, you know, sometimes the temptation is, I know his heart. I just won't have too much to do with him. Or maybe we do it without thinking. Like, yeah, he's just not my type. He's on a different path than me. I'm just going to let him go his way, but I'm not. Yeah, I'll just do my thing. I just don't think that's my responsibility to choose that, to decide that. As a church, the church has an authority and a responsibility even, but that judgment should be made by the church, not by an individual. Not by the ministry, I don't think, but by the church. In closing, let's read the rest of the chapter, Matthew chapter 18. And I find the rest of this chapter so interesting because I find it so often the case of myself. Like, I see myself in it so much. And I'd still like to think of this whole chapter and the whole thing. Jesus' love and his desire for the least, the offending, the children. And his desire for us to have relationships that bring those back and to seek the least. And then the rest of this chapter, I think he's still talking about the same thing. I think it's still the same in the same passage. Again, you have that transition verse. Beginning in verse 21, what did I say? Verse 21, begins with, "Then came Peter unto him and said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times?" Jesus saith unto him, "I say not unto thee until seven times, until 70 times seven." In other words, for the rest of your life. "Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. And for as much as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children, and all that he had, and payment to be made. The servant therefore fell down and worshipped him, saying, Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. Then the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion and loosed him, and forgave him the debt. But the same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants, which owed him 100 pence, and he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, Pay me that thou owest. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. And he would not, but went and cast him into prison until he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw that was done, they were sorry, and came and told unto their lord all that was done. Then his lord, after that he had called him, said unto him, O thou wicked servant, I forgave thee all that debt, because thou desirest me. Shouldest thou not also have compassion on thy fellow servant, even as I had pity on thee? And the Lord was wroth and delivered him to the tormentors till he should pay that which was due him. So likewise shall my heavenly Father do also unto you, if ye from your hearts forgive not every one his brother their trespasses." Peter didn't get it, did he? Jesus had given him this teaching. Jesus had instructed how he wants his church to operate. Jesus had instructed how he wanted, who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. He had given his love. He had explained his love. He had explained the love of the Father towards that one individual. And Peter was still looking for a reason to kind of be on top, I think, justify himself. How often do I have to do this, though? Yeah, I understand the forgiveness things, but how often? 7 times? Not 7 times, 70 times 7. In other words, this is a lifestyle. Forgiveness. It's a part of life. And the only way we can ever live this, and the only way we can ever understand this, is if we understand the debt that we have been forgiven. Is if we can see the offense, whether it be towards me or whether it be towards someone else, or if we can see that in light of the forgiveness that has been extended to me. Those slights, those sins, those trip-ups of our brothers and our sisters pale in comparison towards what we have been forgiven. There was no way we could pay. Our entire being was against God. There was no way we could pay back what we owed. And we were forgiven. And we cannot help but to forgive. And if we understand this forgiveness, is when we can truly desire to seek forgiveness, or to help our brother, to help others into the fold. Peter understood it later. He understood this forgiveness, I believe, when he was in prison and he was able to sing. I think his desire was to bring others into the fold at that point. That was what he understood that. Stephen understood it. Think of Stephen. The crowd had taken him out, and I'm not sure exactly how it was, but from, I think, the way we understand stonings, often they took him to the edge of a cliff and they pushed him over, and then they rained stones down on him. What was Stephen's heart toward his persecutors? What was Stephen's heart towards the ones that were offending him? True, they were not ones that had been in the church. They were not brothers, I wouldn't call them. But what was his heart toward them? Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. As he was at the end of his life, he had people taking his life. He had those stones raining down on him. He knew he was going to lose his life. The heavens opened up and he saw Jesus standing there. And he prayed for his persecutors, for those that had offended him. Our Lord did it. Jesus. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. His desire was to bring those straying sheep into his fold. He was able to extend that forgiveness. But so often we miss it. Just like Peter. Don't be too hard on him. I can get so caught up in righting the wrongs, making sure that I'm taken care of, that I miss that heart of restoration. Doesn't mean we don't at times cry for justice or long for justice. It's in our nature. The souls of the martyrs under the altar. How, Lord, how long, Lord, how long? They want justice. But meeting out justice belongs to God alone, I believe. God's will for the church is not that we seek justice, but it is, I think, that we go out and we seek that one. That one that's missing, that's straying. James 5, verses 19 through 20, familiar verses. Very end of the chapter here. It's almost like James wraps his epistle to the church to a close, and then he's like, oh yes, and this yet. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his ways shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. I don't know that we can add anything to these verses. I don't know that we can improve on these verses. But that's a priority in Jesus' kingdom. That's the heart of Christ, I believe, to seek those that are lost and to bring them into the fold. And the burden of the message, I guess, this morning is that our own selves don't come in the way of that. That my priority is God's priority, is Jesus' priority in bringing those into the fold. That my selfishness, making sure I'm taken care of, my own desire for justice doesn't get in the way than that. If we can restore an erring soul to the kingdom, this man shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. That's so much more important than the ways that I have been hurt or the ways that I have been misused. This, I believe, is the heart of Christ. Shall we kneel for prayer?